Blog Talk Radio.
Beer and Tall Buildings.
October 7th, 2011. Episode 25, Aesthetic Ecstasy. This week, we sit in on a talk about the aesthetic ecstasy of Adida Samraj's artwork. In the presence of the artists Orpheus and Linnaeid exhibition, which closes this weekend at Sindaram Tagore Gallery, the discussion turns to that forbidden S-word, spirituality, and we uncover an idea or two about how we look at art, and in return, how art looks at us. The panelists are Bill Bush, Shana Nees Dambrot, Gary Coates, and Stanley Hastings, and the moderator is Peter Frank. We'll listen in for the entirety of the panel. The approximate runtime is 1 hour and 15 minutes.
Good evening, and thank you all for coming to our panel tonight. If you needed reminding, the panel is called Orpheus in the Modern World. I couldn't remember if it was Adida Samraj's aesthetic ecstasy or the aesthetic ecstasy of Adida Samraj. Either one would be appropriate, but they will mean different things. It's a wider gap of meaning than you might think, and that's probably where we'll be investigating this evening. I'm Peter Frank. I'm a contributor to Huffington Post, et cetera, et cetera. And on my far right, your far left, is Bill Bush, who's currently publisher of Art Week LA, a leading online magazine dedicated to the Los Angeles art scene. He contributes weekly to the Huffington Post, and when we were all doing The Magazine Los Angeles, of which I was the editor, he was the publisher. Professor Gary J. Coates, next to me, is the Victor L. Regnier. Is this Regnier or Regnier?
Regnier.
Victor L. Regnier, Distinguished Faculty Chair in the Department of Architecture at Kansas State University. Gary has written a number of published articles on the art of Adida Samraj, including The Rebirth of Sacred Art, Reflections on the Aperspectival Geometric Art of Adida Samraj. On my immediate left, your right, is Shana Nees Dambrot. You know, as long as I've known you, I've never known which syllable to stress.
I don't know. Now's the time.
Okay, no time like the present.
Okay, it's Dambrot, and it's a little unbalanced because there was once a Central European Jewish suffix long lost in the fog of war attached to it, so it is...
That may be what's throwing me off. Yeah, okay. Shana is an art critic, curator, and author based downtown L.A. She's art and books editor of L.A. Canvas and a writer for the L.A. Weekly, as well as L.A. Reviews editor for WhiteHotMagazine.com. And on her left is Stanley Hastings, who's co-director and general manager of Dot Plastique, which is the studio responsible for the fabrication and dissemination of the work of artwork of Adida Samraj. He is director of fabrications for Dot Plastique, and that's to supervise the fabrication of the objects on the wall around us, and spent 15 years working with the artist until the artist passed in 2008. I'm going to open up the... we're going to bring you in fairly soon, but I'm going to open up the panel immediately, asking Professor Coates to discuss the relationship of... effectively, the relationship of form to content in this work, in this body of work, the Orpheus and Linnaeid. All the works you see around you are taken from the Orpheus and Linnaeid series, and I'll leave it to Professor Coates and perhaps to Stanley Hastings to illumine the distinction between the two series, their place in Adidas Samraj's oeuvre, and the function of form as a supporter of content and vice versa.
Thank you, Peter. Adida once wrote that in his book of essays, Transcendental Realism, extraordinary book by any account, that the tension between form and meaning ran through all of his artistic production altogether. And so we could well begin with these pieces by looking at the traditional Orpheus myth. How many people are familiar with the Orpheus myth? I could recount it briefly for you. And the story, it's an ancient Greek myth. It's told by a number of different people over the centuries, and it has been rediscovered and reinterpreted almost with every generation. So it's got a long story kind of lineage of exposition and interpretation. But the heart of it is that Orpheus, I believe he was the child of a god and a mortal. Calliope was his mother, and his father was it Zeus,
Apollo,
and his great virtue and gift was that he could play the lyre or the harp so sweetly, so beautifully, that all of nature was brought into harmony and bliss by his musical gifts. And he married Eurydice, his great love, and on their marriage day, she was bitten by a snake and died and went to Hades, the afterworld state that the Greeks imagined as the place that one went. And Orpheus was absolutely shattered and heartbroken and set upon the task of going into Hades to bring her back. Mortals just don't do that. I think he was maybe the first and the last to have attempted this. But in any case, he descended into the afterlife world and crossed with Charon, the boatman, crossed the river Styx and went to plead his case. And he played his harp. That's why Charon took him across the river, because he was utterly transfixed by the love, blissful music of his harp. And he went and pleaded his case and finally said, yes, all right, she can go with you out of here. She'll return here, of course, like everyone. But here's the deal. You go out, but you can't look back. When you are in the above ground world, yes, then you can look back. And so she was, of course, already a shade. She was already fading. That's how the Greeks understood the condition of people in the afterlife state. And so he couldn't hear her behind him. And he got out into the bright daylight world and turned around, but he turned around a moment too soon, because the deal was if he turned around and looked back, he would lose her again. And that's exactly what happened. And it was a doubly then shattering experience for Orpheus, and some versions of the myth, he went back and tried to once again cross the river Styx and said, nope, that's it, you've had your last chance. He returned to the above, to the world of life, above ground, but was tormented with this sense of loss and sorrow and longing, and wandered madly through the forests and played his harp and sung of his loss. And one version or several versions of the story say that the Maenads, the sort of wild, crazy women that the Greeks described, tore him to pieces. And even when his head was floating down the river, he was still singing so sweetly that the trees and every living thing was moved to tears by his sorrowful song. Well, why would, you know, Adi Da choose this myth? And, you know, we tend to say, well, that's a Greek myth, it's a Greek story, we don't follow that religion anymore, it's not so relevant, and yet that is the archetypal human tragedy of all beings who perceive themselves to be separate and mortal and conditional and limited. If we look around, if you look to your left or to your right or behind you, we're all passing, we're all mortal, we'll all be gone. That is the human condition. The Orpheus myth is our story. It is an eternal, an ongoing story, and Adi Da addressed that story because it is the archetype of mortal tragedy. Now, we're blessed, I think, to be in this room surrounded by this magnificent art. And what do you think is your first impression of this art? What, at a feeling level, pre-reflective, not intellectual, what's your feeling response to the pieces we're immersed in? Well, I think they're kind of happy. One doesn't say, yeah, that's the Orpheus myth, that tragedy, that Greek tragedy, there we can look at it. And of course, that's the whole point, because his work, his artistic interpretation, reinterpretation of that ancient myth of mortal tragedy, he's converted it into a divine comedy. And what he's saying is that if you look at the titles of different pieces, the illusory fall into mortality and conditionality, and he's addressing the fact that we have a completely mistaken sense of identity. We are not, in the end, merely mortal, conditional, suffering beings. I saw a T-shirt at the airport coming out here. Young man, and he said, nobody gets out of here alive. And then I understand that Adi Da had said that, and exactly in some cases. I thought it was interesting to see that T-shirt from this young man. Well, if you look at these pieces, his retelling of that story, there is a descent of Orpheus into the world, the red-yellow world of torment and suffering and conditionality and mortality, where Eurydice believes herself to be trapped and unable to escape. And yet, if you look at the different pieces, I think it's also interesting he always worked in suites, because suites are associated with music, just like Orpheus is associated with music. And there is an abstract narrative being told, and those three pieces over there, these two pieces, this is part of a larger suite, these others are. And what one sees in that triptych over there is that, yes, there is Orpheus, clearly a male figure, clearly a female figure. And what the narrative is saying is that even the red-yellow realm of apparent mortality and suffering is suffused, is undergirded, is arising within the white field of transcendental, unconditional light. Loveless happiness is the reality of all apparently mortal beings. And so this is a radical retelling and another way to communicate his spiritual teachings through the imagery, the archetypal imagery of art. And I could talk more about that, but I've talked way too much already. So, in any case, that I think sets the stage for, you know, what the context is for these pieces.
Thank you. For actually, Sheena and I had a question, a clarification. Calliope was the muse of music.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so Orpheus was the descendant of the source of music in human experience.
Which makes sense. Yeah. It's funny while you were talking though, because I was thinking when the story of Orpheus, The moral of that story that I always took away from it was, if they tell you don't turn around, don't turn around. Right? So that the real tragedy of humanity is our own inability to follow even really clear, common sense direction, and to be able to exert control over our own self-destructive impulses. And it resonates with me with like the story of Lot and, you know, Lot's wife and Sawyer's fault and all that. And and it's funny because that's kind of, you know, vis-a-vis the spiritual content, which is one of the most interesting aspects of it to me and sort of like what I came to talk about, having to do with this, that kind of, like, I don't know anything about his specific teachings, but I do know that the more I learn about it, everything I hear kind of reminds me of the things that I like best about Judaism and the kind of reform, secular kind of Judaism that my family practiced, where it's about ideas and the emphasis is on this existential level, you know, of being, where, you know, the 617 mitzvahs to make, you know, without, and it's, and you're not really operating under a thread of like hell or the reward of heaven or even worried about the next life. It's about this one here. And so that there's a lot of really interesting sort of, you know, what I always think of as this kind of secular mysticism that's based in like mindful awareness of, you know, how you affect your immediate surroundings with what you do. That is a little bit paradoxical, but that I kind of understand through that relationship to the old Jewish teachings that are, like I said, emphasize, you know, the impact of your behavior. And so when I, you know, thinking about that, I realized, especially since we moved to California, that right from the beginning we're on sort of shaky ground, because for some reason, that maybe everybody would have an idea about this, when you use the word spiritual when you're discussing modern and contemporary art, people freak out and shut down right away. Huh. They don't want to know about it. I mean, short of like the Rothko Chapel, people are not comfortable discussing art as having a spiritual purpose or polemic or mission or underpinning. And I don't know why that is, but it's common. And I kind of thought maybe when I left New York and came here that people would be a little bit more chill about it, but it's actually almost worse out here. And I don't know what that's about, but I do know that there are a lot of movements that have that kind of secular spiritualism underpinning their aesthetic choices, and this is maybe the most well-articulated version of that I've seen. But I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about that, since I think maybe you and Stanley both are probably the people up here most qualified to talk about what he saw as the kind of spiritual function of the work that he was making. Okay. So I'm really curious.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Adida said it's spiritual work, but not necessarily religious work. Mm-hmm. That's not what this work is about. And in what he means by spiritual is sacred and set apart, and I'd say more than secular, esoteric. And, you know, but by spiritual, he means it can be work that you can participate with and actually have an experience that's beyond self or sense of self. And in fact, I think that's what the work is all about. It's about drawing the participants beyond the self. And he said that the principal purpose of his work is to draw the participant into a condition of ecstasy, to become happy. He said that's the primary impulse of human beings, is to be happy, of all beings.
Ecstasy literally meaning out of your being.
Beyond oneself.
Right.
Beyond
exactly.
One's presumed separate self.
And so that's why, you know, Adida Samraj's aesthetic ecstasy, as Peter titled the panel, that's really the fundamental nature of what Adida's work is all about.
You have a response?
Well, no. I follow that train of thought and recall in his writing that when he speaks of ecstasy, he talks about that moment before knowing. You know, that moment before I steps in.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, you know, I funny as I was kind of reading a little bit earlier today in preparation, I couldn't help but pick up a copy of Be Here Now, which I've been dragging around for the last 35 years.
And, ironically.
And as I opened it, of course, it fell apart because the binding on it is
even
gone.
Better.
I knew that was, you know, where Adidas, or what sounded to me like where Adidas was coming from. And I really appreciate that moment before the ego steps in place and says, oh, let me take over, I know what's going on. And
right.
So it's that distinction between perceptive thinking and what we've all been trained and thought in, which is, you know, more the liberal arts side,
mm-hmm.
of mathematics, because
mm-hmm.
there's sensibility, we can reason, we can make
mm-hmm.
sense of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And this takes you outside of your safety zone of knowing.
Yes.
And into a different place, which is frankly probably a more natural place. It's probably a place that we've been pulled away from since childhood.
My sister gave birth to a little boy a couple of years ago, and it's been such a treat to watch him begin to grow up. But then to see before the whole conceptual mind starts to be trained and you start to get the sense of separate self and other, how often he just sits there in this perceptual condition that looks so blissful. You know, and Adidas speaks about the bliss of the perceptual experience, that's actually what, you know, he's meaning to convey with the art, that it's something that he can't get at with words, it's something that you actually experience when you're simply perceiving.
And that's part of the reason for the reductive strategy, that
mm-hmm.
abstracts
mm-hmm.
these from the original images,
right.
Because the idea is to take enough out that I have to pick my own story, right, when I'm looking at it. I can't just passively absorb it because there's not really enough for me to rest on, but that there is enough to stop me from physically moving. Like,
sure.
It's enough to keep me in front of it, but then it's this kind of liminal state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, you know, we were talking about how the other phases of the work that still have this sort of maximum capacity and density of all the information that he starts with, which would have, you know, additive in the extreme. I personally love, just as a taste thing, like, kind of, you know, that's my deal, but that is, by its very nature, narrative and specific.
And representation.
So because you're looking at a picture of people doing things in places,
mm-hmm.
with objects you recognize,
mm-hmm.
there's no motivation to go beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And that even though I happen to love visual art that tells a story and, you know, kind of, I feel like you can get around to that same kind of ecstasy by over-maximalizing, you know, that kind of Kandinsky effect. But, you know, I totally understand. But so that's kind of, it's like there's a purpose, but there's no right answer,
mm-hmm.
kind of.
Well, one recourse to, one basic reason for Adidas or any artist's recourse to abstraction is to place the viewer back in the process of not of experience, not simply interpretation,
mm-hmm.
a narrative image per se tells the story for you and before
yeah.
you, and
that's wonderful. I mean, it's not like
that is a particular level of experience and communication
against that. It's just.
No, this expands it. This pulls you in. This allows for the receptive interpretation, or actually interpretive reception.
See, that makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
well,
these
are very. It's very difficult to look at his work as opposed to other artwork, and because it's certainly my first response to viewing artwork is to kind of relate to it. That, again, it goes to that point of view, who am I in this? And this is very difficult to do that with. It makes you kind of crazy in a way, if I can say
right
that, you're looking at
yeah.
it. And you can't figure it out.
That's
the
purpose right there.
Yeah.
That's why
you
do it. That's why he calls it the aperspectival art. It's actually
ah.
here on the title of Gary's essay, Reflections on the Aperspectival Geometric Art of Adidas Samraj. Because he wanted the viewer to go beyond perspective. And
mm-hmm.
if you look at all these images, but even if you were to pull the catalog of the photographic imagery that he did in the earlier years from the shelves back here, you'd see it's all about the going beyond point of view, which is the going beyond of locating the difference in self and space.
Mm-hmm.
And so you cannot find a perspective in any of his images, even in the representational images.
Well, it's more than simply, well, you both have the there is no perception of perspective per se. In other words, a pictorial depth,
Or ego point of view.
That's what I was moving to. What this depicts is not the disillusion of the ego, but the absence of it.
Mm.
He said even apparently representational imagery, figural representations, reinforces the sense of point of view and separate and separativeness.
Mm-hmm.
And as he worked through this suite and over the course of his work, he kept working more and more intensely to remove any of the scaffolding that would support the ego.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he made his pieces, of course, monumental, because the tendency is, if it's small, the ego can kind of surround it and box it in, mm-hmm. and contain it and domesticate it and control it in some way, no matter what the image might be.
Mm-hmm.
So his images are monumental, so that it's hard to find that privileged position where you can kind of control the action.
Interestingly, he's relying on color relationships to confuse visual depth.
Mm-hmm.
He's relying on Hoffman's push-pull, the relationships of advancing and receding colors. And he stresses that by relying on primaries. These would be right out of the tube if they were out of the tube.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the other thing out of the tube. I mean, in that effort to remove that sort of ego perspective, we were talking a little bit yesterday about how important it was to see no physical trace of the hand, mm-hmm. of the artist, and that they're made this way for a reason, and that you refer to them as being fabricated for a reason. I mean, before he died, I've been interrogating about this, this is the logistics of this, but there's this archive of literally thousands of these images that he made, approved, ordered, set up, and enough of them were made that you know exactly what they're supposed to look like when they're done. And it's sort of like, I made the analogy that it's like my friend who worked for Robert Graham, whose job is finishing the editions that Robert had started, approved, and done artist proofs of before he died, because even if Robert was still alive, that would be his job.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really not all that. And so even though these aren't editions, that's kind of how it helped me to understand that. But that part of the reason that that's okay is because even when he was still with us, he didn't want the physical trace of a man that made this in a place that you usually are a woman, but a human that physically made this by hand in a time and place, singularly, and with all of that kind of comes with that, ego-wise, and that he was very, very important to him. It's almost like it makes more sense that it should be made after he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a kind of logical extension of this campaign of removal of himself,
mm-hmm.
from it.
These are not handmade works to begin
with.
Much like a straight ahead photograph. That particularly a digital photograph that goes through no process of of darkroom developing, et cetera, et cetera. These are actually, they are hand tooled, and there is craftsman input into finishing them. But in the creation of the images themselves, they might as well have been created by a shutter.
He specifically didn't want them having any depth. Very specifically,
mm-hmm.
and that goes to the same point of them being a perspective.
You're talking about optical depth.
Optical depth. Mm-hmm. No, physical depth either.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted them a perfectly flat surface, so he didn't want even the depth of a stroke of paint, even the depth of, these are silk screens, he didn't even want the depth of the layers of the different inks on one on top of the other. And so you'll see as you get close to the images, they then have a clear coat that's then sanded perfectly flat, and then another clear coat, so they're perfectly flat.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted it that way because in some sense that allows you to enter deeper into it rather than locating yourself in relationship to it
or locating the artist in the manufacturer.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he also never signed the works by hand for a number of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One, he said it's an egoic process of putting your name on it or putting it on the front or side.
Mm-hmm.
there is a signature plate on the back. That's a laser engraved plate that goes on the back. Mm-hmm. That's how he always did it. He didn't want to establish any more value to those made before his lifetime than those after. But it should be very clearly understood that he was very, very involved in the fabrication process and in the establishment of this form of fabrication. He worked specifically with Peter Carlson, who was the director and founder of Carlson & Company here, who made all Jeff Koons' balloon dogs and Ellsworth Kelly's monumental sculptures and so forth. And they had this amazing dialogue and this process that happened from Fiji, where Adi Da was living and working, it's a very remote island there, to Los Angeles. And he worked developing precisely how his fabrications would be made beyond his lifetime. He knew that there was only so many that could be made while he was alive. And he didn't even want to be encumbered by the amount of time that it took to fabricate them. So with a stroke of genius, he created this means of being able to work rapidly in creating imagery on a digital canvas, but then selecting precisely this blue, this red, this yellow. Call it, you know, he wanted a lipstick red. What's a lipstick red? You know, we spent all these different shades over, and then he'd say, that's my red, exactly. The blue, for example, we all thought, well, maybe the blue, because you have to do this interpretive process going from this projection screen to what it looks like as a lacquer. And so, you know, we all had an idea of what the blue is supposed to be, and we sent these different variations to him. But the one that closely matched what he was doing on the screen is this blue, and this is precisely the blue he wanted. It's a much lighter and more subtle blue than we all thought it was. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, color has profound force and meaning, and he was so specific about how it would all be done. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, he received the final, he'd overseen the whole process and all the different samples and colors and picked them all, and we did the first show of them, and then we brought a finalized fabrication to him in November of 2008, which he received and loved. And he said that was the direction he was looking to go and realize with his art from the beginning of creating these images digitally. And he passed 1 week later. So the final form of his artistic work was established, you know, for all time at that time.
I just think it's interesting because it's one of these, you know, sort of mental origamis that you can, that if you're like an art nerd, you can have fun with forever and ever, which is this idea that his vision, which is specific and sort of, you know, archetypal on this scale that he operated on, but which was deliberate about taking himself out of the equation for a specific reason that relates back to a kind of spiritual practice. And, you know, that kind of like back and forthness of how these things came to be. I think it's really interesting though, but you started out asking about the relationship of form to content. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I wanted to talk, make sure somebody who knew what they were saying talked about this whole idea of hand of the artist, because in one way it is an absolutely individual, specific vision that's being executed, mm-hmm. but it's a vision that attempts to obliterate the privilege of the individual, and mm-hmm. I kind of love that.
It's also
not
as a, although he's clearly a direct descendant of, and in fact very, very self-conscious revitalizer of the modern impulse to this transcendence of transcendence through abstraction. Adi Da was involved in an induced meaning, an induced experience, where there is the exploration that goes on in so much modern art and modern painting, and so much contemporary painting too. The fact that the artists are, when we say they're expressing themselves, as often as not, they're not expressing ideas, but discovering them; not expressing manners of working, but discovering them, and exploring what can be done. There's the exploration here is already done. Mm-hmm. It's done before these are created. This is a method of communicating in both information and experience, attitude, and worldview. And with an emphasis on the world, not on the view.
He said these were direct presentations of reality itself, or that which is already always the case, before any ego or point of view or presumed separateness arises.
Mm-hmm.
He says in reality itself there is simply no separate point of view, no separate ego. And that was his own realized state, and this is the direct communication of that state. So of course there can be, all these qualities have to be the case. I also think it's very interesting, we look at the colors, and I was triggered by your mention of the notion of color perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Rudolf Steiner worked a lot with that, and he was a great influence on many of the early modernists, especially Kandinsky, also Mondrian. But if you look at these colors, they're all radiant, suffused with light. There's blues and there's blues, but this blue is coming at you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, even color perspective has tended to be flattened out by his choice of the particular values and intensities and hues of the primaries that he's working with. It doesn't add a kind of illusional depth to the, mm-hmm. to the surface.
Although it's funny, the blues to me have a concavity to them. The same way that yellows have a convexity.
That's interesting.
It's subtle, and the fact that he bounds them in these stark black outlines brings their edges, like stained glass windows, bring their edges to the surface, so that emphasizing that convexity and unconcavity,
mm-hmm.
as if these colors are stretched over curved membranes.
Well, I think he's kind of playing, much like when you put a pencil in a glass of water and all of a sudden the pencil appears to be split, but it's actually not split.
Right.
So it's kind of a play on perception and reality and uses the colors in that manner,
mm-hmm.
to help pull you into that state.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up Mondrian too, because of course you sort of can't help it, right? But one thing, you know, among the many things that we could point out that they do not share, one of the things that they do was, as I understood the initial impetus behind, like, the steel and all that it came out of, was to find a way to, I mean, it was art, it was like the art world-centric microcosmic version of the spiritual program, right? It was like, find a language that is both sufficiently dramatic and reductive so as to transcend class-based and education-based barriers and communicate something directly to everyone from the nobility to a factory worker, because everyone deserves art and everyone has a human experience, and can we find an art that gets past what you have to have had learned in an academy in order to understand it. And of course the irony is in that case it actually wound up being even more rarefied and, mm-hmm. and elitist.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was when it was pictures of like a tree.
Right.
No, I don't know. I'm not saying that about this. I'm saying it's ironic about Mondrian, but you know, that was the idea. It was mm-hmm. to reduce the world out there to basic enough, fundamental enough ingredients.
A universal language.
Yes,
exactly.
He wanted to arrive at the essential of things mm-hmm. through that abstraction.
Mondrian,
yeah. And so the essential core of reality, which he felt was more depicted through these abstractions, and even mm-hmm. put squares around the mm-hmm. shapes or the colors so they wouldn't even be representational shapes. I think there's a lot of that in Adida's work. We were discussing one of the suites that he created, a video suite, he titled What Is Not an Idea.
Yeah,
and that's a lot of what his art's about. He also calls another suite What Is Not an Object, because they're about what is before the mind, as you were alluding to at the beginning there, Bill.
That's like the sort of thing you would say.
It's also interesting, now that we're talking and comparing with Mondrian, of course he came up with the quintessential vertical and horizontal.
Mm-hmm. The vertical representing all sorts of things, and the horizontal representing all sorts of things, and all those
manifestation,
things,
the ways in which they intersect,
right, the male and the female,
the architectural and the human.
Right, exactly.
But I'm very struck by the fact that Adida's primary root geometries, out of which he builds a dynamic play and tension of visual forces, of the square, the circle, and the triangle.
Very deliberately.
And the, you know, the angular, the linear, the curved, mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. broader terms. And then against that, he has a play of his freely hand-drawn line work, which is imported into the computer computer, and then he worked with his technical staff to compose with those elements. It's sort of that reminds me a little bit of Islamic art, where they have the sort of geometric art and then the arabesques and the calligraphy with its movements. So mm-hmm. It's sort of an archetypal language of the geometric and the curve.
He was influenced by that.
And you know, had great appreciation for that. Mm-hmm. In his work, it is radically free, and there's a sense of movement in it. I'm a great lover of Islamic art. And yet this art, and I've talked with colleagues who have written a lot about Islamic art and architecture, there is the element of time and movement and dynamic play that enters into it, especially because of the suites. You know, each suite is a kind of moving image of time that you, mm-hmm. you begin to see patterns jumping from one panel to the next, and things rising and falling and metamorphizing and all the rest. And those qualities are not in Islamic art, although the fundamental language, perhaps, of the lineat, as he called his mm-hmm. line work, and the geometric is in this work. So,
and also the challenge of how to express human things without pictures of humans.
Right.
And that's mm-hmm. and, yeah. Yeah. But I mean, yeah. You know, like recognizable
no,
pictures.
I know.
Yeah.
But
I mean, that's. I know we looked at this, and we had a whole thing moment yesterday where we looked at a photograph, and
yeah.
It's like, oh my God, it's the same thing, and mind melt. But the idea that for different reasons there are prescriptions
right.
and discouragements against mm-hmm. using the human
yes.
figure in Islamic
yeah.
art, and yet it's some of the most sensual, elaborate,
mm-hmm.
intelligent, mathematical, meaningful, historically saturated, you know, app narrative, they found a way to do it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a completely different thing because it's finding a way out from under something that maybe we might consider repressive or something, and this is not
mm-hmm.
about that kind of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more like about the kind of, you can't, it's like you can't stop, you know, water from running downhill. People's art is going to have people.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the human experience, but to find a way to represent that without it just being a picture of it, you know, might be
mm-hmm.
another reason that we're sensing some
yeah.
affinity
mm-hmm.
with it.
Well,
it's
interesting. There is a constant back and forth. There's none of these works have it, but there are other works in these series, in fact, where there are clear depictions of people drawn from simplified photographic sources.
And of course, once someone points it out to you, like you did with this triptych, then it's there. It's not like
yeah.
it's hard to see.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it's, you know.
Yeah, but there isn't a process of abstraction. There isn't a presumption of non-objectivity. There is a discourse between seeing things there and simply reading shapes. Knowing presences and seeing and comprehending design, and in other words, we can't say this is abstract as opposed to non-objective. This is not figurative. This is figurative. This is not. It's obvious. It's representational, but it's presentational. That our points of view, our labels start to break down.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the process of generating these particular bodies of work, they broke down in terms of process and conceptualization.
So maybe that's one of the most important things that he's brought through his work is an opportunity for people to kind of experience who they are at that, you know, at that level of ecstasy, to get beyond what we do when we confront other people and we start bringing our own labels and ideas and thoughts in. And we're so busy listening to that voice of what we think and maybe not. You know, it's not a voice that we're even generating, it's a voice that
yeah.
just occurs for us,
mm-hmm.
that this is something that gets that voice going in such a
the voice is, the voice has the voice outside, the
exactly.
voice inside.
Exactly.
Right.
I think it's described in the title he gives his artwork, which is Transcendental Realism, And the subtitle is The Image Art of Egoless Participation in Reality Itself. Mm-hmm. The Image Art of Egoless Participation in Reality Itself.
Well, and that takes a lot of time, and that's why I appreciate the scale of his work, mm-hmm. is because this is not scale of work that you step back to get the whole picture.
Right.
This is scale of work that you get into,
right.
mm-hmm. In order to get the whole picture.
With it. And by the way, when he worked, for those of us who had the opportunity to see him work, Chid Amanati Constance here this evening has some of his image art on that he gave her, but she saw him work for decades, and you know, I think the most beautiful example of that subtitle, The Image Art of Egoless Participation in Reality Itself, is the way he worked. It was a totally ecstatic process. It was like there was no mediation between he and his image art. There was this extraordinary concentration. It would go on for hours, and this amazing productivity. He'd create image after image after image, but it was a completely exalted process also. It was one where the gesture of his hand and the way that he worked was a dance that was similar to what you actually see here on the wall. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful demonstration, really, of his realization. And that, you know, goes without saying that Adida's work reflects something of his realization also.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love what he said about how people respond to, for example, music, is that you can see people
right.
reach a state of ecstasy
right.
when they start closing their eyes, listening to music, and kind of
right.
waving to the music,
right.
and that his desire was to bring that same experience through another art
That's
form.
Exactly right. He used to say how people go to a concert and they really get with it. You know, they get down to it, they start to sway, they start to groove with it, they kind of forget themselves and become ecstatic. He said, yet oftentimes people go into the museum setting or whatnot and they get very analytical, you know, and they try to...
Self-conscious.
Yeah, self-conscious, try to figure out what's it about. He said, that's not what my art's meant to do. He said, my art meant to draw you into that same sort of ecstatic condition. Just allow yourself to go with it, so...
At this point, I'd like to invite anyone in the audience to participate in this discussion as well.
Egolessly.
Precisely. I mean, and that to encourage you not simply to ask questions of us or anyone else, but to provide your own observations. We just happen to have at this point some more information than you might, and some of us have less information than some of you might, and. So we invite you to share what you might observe. But as you can see, we can keep talking while you're figuring out.
We don't keep talking.
Exactly.
That's what he's saying.
Right.
Yes, no problem.
Please.
Yes, you're in the front row.
Well, one of my favorite things, you know, it's just a little phrase that I like, but when I encounter it, it's also a thing that I like to look at, is this idea. I know it's random, but when I was a teenager, my dad lived in Japan for a really long time, and so I went over there for the summer, and then, you know, you do all the things that, like, a teenager would do. But one of the things I took was Ikebana flower arranging. I swear to God, this is really an answer. And what I learned there, 15 years old, was that there is such a thing as asymmetrical balance. Right? And that sort of like just went into the brain, and then later when I started studying art history and, you know, looking at stuff and taking it apart, that, you know, has kind of stuck with me. And this idea that you can achieve the harmonious aims of feeling of, you know, sort of tranquility or whatever it is that symmetry presents without necessarily making a symmetrical image, and that has is more like that's a kind of a neat trick, but that when people are good at it, it's almost like a little magical kind of thing that happens. And I think there's a lot of that here.
Well, in fact, the least stable panel in this whole place is that the rightmost one in the triptych, because it is the most symmetrical. It threatens at any moment to roll apart.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, as exemplary. Uh-huh.
There is a sense of purpose in it.
Yeah.
One of the principles in transcendental realism, he says, in each image, symmetry and asymmetry has to be included.
But you look at reality and you see it all over us. Sorry, Gary.
Go ahead.
But if you look at his photographic imagery, for example, he did a tremendous amount of work where he would take an image and then he would flip it. And he would put the two together, totally symmetrical. And then he would do the next one in the series, and there he would add an asymmetrical element to it. And, you know, he would point out, you look at the human body, and there's a particular symmetry, and yet there's an asymmetry. You look at the man and the woman, there's a certain symmetry in both, you know, in terms of our organic makeup, but then there's, of course, the asymmetry of the yin and the yang, the male and female. You look at the panels behind us here, I guess there's a certain symmetry to them, both of them with the circles and with the squares, but then the asymmetry to it. It's reality itself. And that's what that's what he describes his art as the image art of reality itself. He describes that really that's all the God there is reality itself.
So it seems less perfect, but in fact is more familiar and correct, resonant.
I guess, the other thing, my first response when you said that was, I don't know. Yeah. And I think that's really a big part of Adida's work also, is that it's about not knowing. You know, like we're up here talking right now, but he says ultimately my work is about, he said it's really not about words. It's about just simply allowing yourself to participate in it and not try to describe what it's about.
Mm. He could have told me that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Harmony and discord. Yeah.
Harmony and discord.
Mm-hmm. Well, and which actually is a modernist principle. Finding, establishing new senses of harmony by exploring traditional what are traditionally considered discordant, and considering if harmony is a form of symmetry, how fragile it is, and how ultimately elusive it is.
So it's lasted in Orpheus.
Exactly, as did Stravinsky.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think we also have to note that there are qualities in his work of playfulness, spontaneity, humor. It's a body and life positive kind of art. It's not disembodied, abstracted.
Mm-hmm.
It's transcendental realism. It encompasses the conditional and the non-conditional realms simultaneously, one arising perhaps within the other, but
and in fact,
they're both present
right,
in each of the works.
Everything, nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. In recent theoretical terms, transcendental realism are almost opposed terms. Whether you're talking about realism in terms of the depiction of what you're seeing as realism, or the art of the real, the minimalist idea of what you see is what you see, what's there is what's real. Well, he's posing all that. If you walk into these, you'll hurt your nose as badly as you would if walking into a window. But at the same time, their pictorial qualities, which are not available in a Don Judd, transcend the very fact of their concrete presence before you.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to the theme I started with, this form and meaning relationship. And the fact that he chose for these major suites, where he actually made the transition from somewhat representational to purely abstract expression, that the Orpheus myth, you know, they were real people, loving and losing and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the origin of the beauty that he's talking about, this notion that all of this is beautiful altogether, what is apparently not beautiful, what apparently is tragic and mortal, all of it is beautiful. It begins in a human love relation, the archetypal human relationship, a man and a woman, and the incredible intensity of that bond and the loss of that relationship, the tragic loss of that relationship. And this idea that you can't separate love from beauty, that you can't separate art from love, ultimately, mm-hmm. that they're intertwined. It's a theme that Plato picked up on, of course, presented through the symposium and other discourses, but it's not a life-denying, body-denying, relationship-denying transcendentalism.
Mm-hmm.
Much of the early modernist work tended towards that kind of we've got to escape or get beyond the mere flesh, etc., coming from the Judeo-Christian, especially the Christian tradition of a kind of life-denying asceticism. We often see perhaps also in other religions in the East, but that was not his point of view. So we have here an archetypal story that is the archetypal human story, and it is the beginning and the end of his communication about the ultimate victory of the transcendental mm-hmm. state, which is our real state in his mm-hmm. presentation.
Well, in that sense, he resolves one argument in modernism between the ascetic and the sensualist.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the sensualist and the ascetic simply exist on the same plane. We experience them as a continuity, not as an opposition.
Mm-hmm. There's another question in the back.
Yes.
Extreme amount of sadness, and that part of joy is allowing that sadness to surface and feel that sadness, which is why I feel that he may have chosen the tragedy that he did.
Mm-hmm.
Because just as there's sadness under joy, there's joy under sadness.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, when you realize that when you realize that that joy isn't going to last forever,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to last forever. When you realize that joy isn't going to last forever, you get sad. When you realize you're not going to last forever, you realize, hey, the joy could last a long time. And that, from that vantage.
Well, ecstasy always reminds me, I also in my other life there, I coach sports. I coach basketball in particular. And anybody that's familiar with sports knows about being in the zone. Where as now the World Series, the